This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, what the latest census results tell us about diversity and racial identity in America. Then, how to make sure the nonverbal cues in your emails and texts are saying what you want to say. Also, people drink caffeine to compensate for not getting enough sleep. How well does that actually work? That's all coming up on Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. America is becoming less white, according to the latest census data. But that doesn't necessarily mean what you might think. Another way to look at it is that more Americans are identifying as white and as some other race. What's driving that? Mark Hugo Lopez is director of race and ethnicity research at the Pew Research Center. He's been crunching these numbers and analyzing the data, and he's with us now on the line. Mr. Lopez, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
What is historic about the racial identity data that the 2020 census has released so far?
Well, it shows that the nation is more diverse than ever, particularly when it comes to the share of the U.S. population that's Black, Latino, Asian, of more than one race, or perhaps even people who might say that their race is some other race. But the share of the U.S. population that says one of those other races is part of their identity compared to where the nation used to be is at its highest level we've ever seen. Turning it around the other way, the share of the U.S. population that is white, single race, non-Hispanic, that is people who say they're only white and they're not Hispanic, is now at 58%. Back in 2000, it was at 69%, and back in 1980, it was over 80%. So over the course of the last five decades, the share of the U.S. population that is white, non-Hispanic, has been in decline, and the share that are, say, Hispanic has risen to almost 20%, according to the latest census data.
So it's still a majority. The majority of Americans still identify as white, period. Right.
That's correct. I think it's important to remember that, because when we take a look at the numbers, for example, the number of people who say they're white, non-Hispanic, for example, is at about 192 million people. The Hispanic population is the second largest population, and that number is at 62 million. So when we're talking about the racial and ethnic groups of the country, the white population is still by far both the majority and the largest single racial or ethnic group.
But for it to be for white single ethnic group to be the white, not Hispanic, to be 58% today, whereas in 1980, which is not that long ago, it was 80%. What happened to all the white people? Or is this people identifying in some other way? You know, people who used to say they were only white and now they're saying something different?
This is a really great question, and I think this is an important point to keep in mind. Over the course of those five or six censuses, 1980, 90, 2000, 2010, and 2020, the way the Census Bureau asks about racial and ethnic identity has changed. Mm. So, for example, in 2000, the U.S. Census Bureau allowed people to select more than one race on the race question, which goes something like, are you white, African-American or Black, Asian or Asian-American, Native American or American Indian, or some other race? And starting in 2000, people could select more than one of those options. Hmm. What happened in 2020 that's also a part of this story is that the Census Bureau conducted the census largely online, so people could go online. And also that meant that the Census Bureau was capturing much longer answers for anybody who might write in something for their racial identity, for example. And so we have much more detail with the 2020 census than we had in the past. What's interesting, you asked about what's happened since 1980. Well, there's been changes in the way the census is asking the question. And interestingly, in the 2020 census, some of the gains in the number of people who say they're multiracial are largely people who say they're white and something else. Mm. So a lot of the gains have been people who may have changed from saying just white back in 2010 to saying that they're white and say Black today. And that seems to be a big part of the story, is just the way the data is coded and just the way the question was asked.
The shift then has been toward allowing people to a lot more nuance in how they define themselves. So there may still be, like, who would the person have been that might have just felt like their only and best option was just white back in 1980? But today they have a lot more nuance.
It may have been somebody, for example, who was of Hispanic background. Back in 2010, the Census Bureau counted 9 million multiracial American adults. In 2020, that number went up to about 34 million. But about half of that gain between 2010 and 2020, and the share of people who say they're more than one race, are people who identified as Hispanic. And oftentimes they're choosing white along with, say, Native American or Indigenous or Black as part of their racial identity. So it's just that more options are available. But, you know, there's also another thing I think that's interesting that's happened in the country over the last 10 years. And that is interest on the part of the U.S. public to understand their ancestry. People, for example, completing DNA tests, going to a number of companies to find out what are their roots. That's led to some awareness of perhaps backgrounds that people didn't quite know about or had some idea about, but got confirmation with due to these DNA tests. So all in all, the nation's view of itself is partly changing, irrespective of the way we ask about racial identity on the census, because people are becoming more aware of their backgrounds and where they're from.
And the census only asks how you identify. It doesn't actually define what white only is or what percentage of Hispanic or African American you need to have in order to also check that box.
That's exactly right, which means that there may be some people who, for example, will say that they know they have a grandmother that's Mexican, for example, but they won't self-identify as Hispanic. So it's up to you on the census form to choose how to identify yourself. And again, these things can change. People's sense of identity can change as society changes, as our perceptions of racial identity evolve. And the nation's gone through a lot of discussions over the last 10 years about racial and ethnic identity.
So do you think that the census data that we're seeing for 2020, one of the things... it doesn't necessarily tell us that a room full of people today is going to be obviously more diverse just by looking at their faces. That a room full of people of average Americans today, it's not necessarily going to be visibly more diverse than a room full of people in 1980.
No, it will be visibly more diverse because there has been some big changes. And I think the two big changes to note here are the growing Asian American population and the growing Hispanic population.
Okay.
And those two groups alone, since 2000, have accounted for about 3/4 of the nation's population growth. So the nation is changing. It is more diverse, but it's also a nation that's more mixed in the sense that many people, when they marry somebody who's not necessarily of the same race or ethnicity. So you see, for example, about 1/4 of all Hispanic newlyweds marry somebody who's not Hispanic, and about almost 30% of Asian American newlyweds marry somebody who's not Asian. So that's a trend that's been going on for at least since 1980, and it really is changing the way in which Americans both see their identity and actually what are the facts about who and where their roots are and who their parents are.
Yeah, so we are both becoming more multiracial biologically, just in terms of like who are your parents, you know, how your parents identified and sort of what that means for you. But Americans are also, do you think, becoming just more comfortable with the idea of race being kind of blurry, like that you don't have to pick white or black or brown. You can sort of, you know, check a lot of boxes.
That's right. And I think people want to tell you about their roots and who they are, and that self-awareness and the desire to claim your roots, to say, this is who I am, is something that many people in our research, in focus groups we've done, in surveys we've done, people just want to have the ability to tell you who they are. And it seems that this last census, the 2020 census, provided more opportunities than previous ones had because of some changes in the way the questions were asked. And it seems that we have heard a lot more from the public about all the different backgrounds they want to identify with.
What is the second largest racial identity group after white only in America?
So if we were to just look at it by race, so not thinking about Hispanics, but Hispanic is an ethnicity, so Hispanics also have a racial distribution. But the second largest group would be a group called some other race. It's actually larger than the Black population, which would be the next largest population, then followed by Asian Americans. But when you take a look at the some other race category, it's a lot of people who are Hispanic, and we haven't quite seen what the responses are to that, because if you indicate some other race on the census form, you write in what your some other race is. And some people will say things like their race is American. Some people will say that their race is the human race. But often, more often than not, many of those some other race respondents are people who said that they are Hispanic as well. And they will oftentimes write in that their race is Latino, or their race is Mexican, or their race is South American. So we have to see what the 2020 census has to collect it on that response category, but and that's to come. But it is interesting that some other race now is larger than the Black population, according to the 2020 census.
Yeah. Well, it speaks to the difficulty that I mean, apparently a lot of people have in sort of deciding what race means to them, or fitting, you know, checking the boxes that the census says race means. But Mark Hugo Lopez, can you explain for me why Hispanic would not be a racial choice? It's an ethnicity. What, under white? Is that how the census does that?
It's a really interesting question, and it's one that has been at the heart of some of the proposed changes that the Census Bureau wants to make. But let me come back to how we got here to having a Hispanic question. So if you remember how the 2020 census worked, there were two questions. The first question is, are you of Hispanic or Latino background? And then the question follows up, if you say yes, to ask, well, what is that? Are you Mexican, Cuban, Puerto Rican, et cetera? Then the next question that respondents get asked is, what is your race? And you're reminded in the race question that Hispanic ethnicity is not a race. So from the Census Bureau's perspective, Hispanicity is an ethnicity. So if you say you're Hispanic, that's an ethnicity and not a racial category.
And ethnicity now, means what? Like it's your cultural identity more so than your blood identity, I guess?
It's tied to a country. It's like you're Salvadoran, or you're Puerto Rican, or you're Dominican, or you're Brazilian. And so ethnicity is tied to some of those countries. Now, even within a country like Mexico, there's a wide diversity of ethnicities, because there are also indigenous groups that trace their roots to being Mayan. So they identify with the Mayan culture and Mayan ethnicity. So there's a lot of nuance here. However, in the Census Bureau's form, we've been asking the questions this way, the two-step question, since 1980. It's something that many Hispanic civil rights groups pushed for actually in the 1960s. And so it captures and gets a direct count of the number of people who identify as Hispanic or Latino. But you asked about it, why isn't this a race? Well, in our surveys that we've done at the Pew Research Center, we've asked Hispanics themselves, do you consider your Hispanic background to be a racial background, an ethnic background, or both? And about two-thirds will say they consider it to be a racial background. So interestingly, the public itself sees it as a race as opposed to an ethnicity. So as you can see, there's a lot of nuance here, even in how the public sees these identities and concepts itself.
Mark Hugo Lopez, the Pew Research Center has recently surveyed Americans about how they feel about this shift, about knowing that America is becoming less white. What did you find?
So we conducted this survey back in July. So this is right before the Census Bureau released their data. So keep that in mind. But we found that 62% of U.S. adults say that it's neither a good thing nor a bad thing that the white population share in the U.S. is declining. And that's interesting, because when you take a look at who says it's a good thing, oftentimes those are younger Americans. Those tend to be Democrats, who are more likely to say it's a good thing that the country's becoming less white. But who says it's a bad thing? Well, it tends to be older Americans. About 35% of those 65 and older say that this is a bad thing for U.S. society. And it tends to be conservative Republicans. 40% of them, for example, say that the declining white share in the U.S. population is bad for U.S. society. So it's interesting. But for the most part, even among those conservative Republicans, you'll find that 57% say it's neither good nor bad that the country is seeing a decline in its share that's white.
What do you think that signifies then for the conversation about race in America, for the conversation about how to talk about race, how to talk about our history of race and discrimination in this country?
Well, a lot of the conversation about race and whether diversity is good or the share white in decline is bad for the country oftentimes revolves around politics, and oftentimes revolves around some very partisan points of view. And so you see that in the very partisan conversations in Washington about what all of these changes might mean for the future, for example, of voting patterns of the U.S. public. If the U.S. public is becoming more diverse, could it be that the nation will become more Democrat Party leaning? I don't know. It remains to be seen, since the 2020 elections showed that Latinos who tend to lean more Democrat, a significant share leaned towards Donald Trump in the 2020 election, which for some may have been a surprise for some analysts. But the other thing that's interesting here is that I think for the public as a whole, the public is thinking about its identity, but I'm not sure if the public is thinking about it in such partisan ways. And many Americans indicate that they're white and something else. So the declining white share in the country also reflects an increasing mixed share in the country. And the public may not have any positive or negative views of that. At least that's what our survey tends to show, because they're part of that story themselves.
This census data will be used to redraw congressional, state, and local election district boundaries for the next decade that they'll be in place. Are there specific demographics? We've talked about race, but also maybe age or regions, specific demographics that seem poised to gain political influence based on this data?
Well, certainly looking at the data, urban places are places that have seen growth, rural places have seen declines. And we've also seen gains in the diversity of the population across a number of different states. So, for example, there's been a rising Latino population share in virtually every corner of the country. So Latinos may benefit from this in some way. But I think it remains to be seen, and we'll have to see how states draw their boundaries. But diversity is not just a story of a few states. It's a story of the nation.
And you say we're seeing also a shift. Is it a dramatic shift or just an ongoing shift toward urban areas, or I guess more areas becoming urban and fewer people living in whatever rural areas exist?
Yeah, so urban areas saw their populations grow over the decade. Rural areas saw their populations decline, and that is a steady trend that we had seen over the course of multiple decades. So it's not necessarily new, but it is something that has been underway for a while. What's interesting here is that urban centers, or urban counties, I should say, grew at a rate of about 10%, while rural counties declined by a few percentage points. Mm. So it's a shift that's been underway for a while as the nation continues to urbanize.
And finally, Mark Hugo Lopez, what about birth rate and just sort of overall growth? Is America's population growing as it has in the past?
Yeah, it's growing at a much slower pace. So the census measured about 331 million people living in the country, and that was up about 7% over 2010. But it's the slowest growth rate that we've seen for the country in a decade since the 1930s. And it reflects a slowing birth rate. So Americans are having fewer children and families are smaller. It also, by the way, reflects a slowdown in immigration, which has been underway for the last 10 years, particularly from Latin America, as fewer immigrants arrive in the United States compared with, say, the 90s or the 2000s. So we are seeing some shifts in the way the nation's population dynamics are evolving, including because as the nation ages, including a higher number of people who are passing away. So death rates as well are part of the story as the country gets older.
We're aging then overall faster than we are, more so than we are a young nation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, it's interesting that a state like California, for example, saw a decline in its under 18 population between 2010 and 2020. And California is not alone in this. Not every state saw its youth population grow. And that reflects how the nation is getting older. Our median age now is over 37 years. And so the nation is an older country than it was just a few decades ago. But again, this reflects a broader international trend of the world's population getting older, as many countries like Japan and Germany and Italy particularly age quickly.
Mark Hugo Lopez is Director of Race and Ethnicity Research at the Pew Research Center. Thank you so much for taking time today, Mr. Lopez. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, people drink caffeine to compensate for not getting enough sleep. Does that actually work? Just ahead, how to make sure the nonverbal cues in your emails and your texts are saying what you think they're saying. I'm Julie Rose. Thank you for tuning in to Top of Mind today. Nearly all of our communication has a digital component these days. Since the pandemic, we even have some relationships that are completely digital. Coworkers you've never actually met in person, for example. With all the texting and emailing and Slacking and Zooming come new opportunities to be misunderstood. What is the digital equivalent of a friendly nod to show that you're paying attention? Does that exclamation point in your friend's text mean she's excited or annoyed? Should you ever use emojis in a work email? Speaker and author Erica Dewan has written a guidebook to all of this. It's called Digital Body Language, and she's with us now. Erica, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What do you mean by the phrase digital body language? I don't have a digital body. I can't have digital body language.
A lot of the ways that we measure relationships is through our nonverbal cues. Research shows roughly 60 to 80% of our communication are our body language cues, such as pacing, pauses, gestures, and tone. But through my research, I've identified that body language hasn't disappeared in a digital world. It is transformed. We now infuse what I call digital body language signals, the new cues that make up the subtext of our messages, everything from an emoji and an exclamation point in an email to how quickly we respond to a text to how we design for inclusion in a video meeting can make or break trust, empathy, and respect today. The problem is many of us were doing it blindly, accidentally, or just plain wrong.
Right, because if I don't know what the digital equivalent of nodding my head in agreement is, and if we haven't agreed on that all together, like this is what it means when you are nodding in agreement, this is how you signify that in a chat thread. I mean, how can we even ever like communicate clearly? It's just lucky that we're not always being misunderstood.
So for so much of our lives, both our work lives and our personal lives, we've relied on those traditional body language signals. If someone was on the verge of tears, we knew how to react to them versus someone really excited who wanted to give us a hug. Now, if we shoot off that email, we have no idea where they may be. And what this requires is a different type of an intentionality. I like to say what was implicit in our traditional body language now must be explicit in our digital body language. Hmm.
Let's give us a couple of examples. You have all these sort of translation tables in the book that I found really enlightening. I was like, oh, I got to print this out and keep it by my desk so I remember. Because I feel like I'm getting a lot of them wrong.
Yeah, let's start with trust, Julie. So in traditional body language, we signal trust through the head nod, by crossing our arms, even smiling. Now, in digital body language, we may signal trust when we send, you know, or mirror someone's emojis or informal punctuation. Once we've gotten to know someone and we start to use shorthand together in digital communication, or it may be signaled by simple things like really being clear and direct and to the point, no need for friendly gestures, or sometimes using those friendly gestures like thank you so much, or I really loved this with a smiley face. It can also be shown by prioritizing timely responses, being quick, sending to the point messages. And it can also be seen by really being thoughtful and engaged in video meetings. That means not multitasking, but using the chat tool to follow up, using your physical body language to also show you're listening in that video meeting. Those are just some examples for trust. Should we talk about excitement?
I want to actually break down a few of the pieces that you just highlighted there. So specifically, if because trust could mean, I guess, when you say trust, you mean like I trust that we're both like engaged in this together and we have a relationship, like a base.
Yes.
Is that what you mean? Okay. Because sometimes I get hung up, and I think it's easy to get hung up on little things in so much of the communication happens on Slack, for example. Yes. In my organization. And so it's kind of an instant messaging thing. It's like faster. It's more instant messaging than it is an email. And sometimes I don't know if I should say okay, as in spell the word out, okay, or just O letter K letter, or just K. Do I need to put an exclamation point to show that I agree? You know, this seems like there's so many different ways to write the word okay in a text thread. What should I be keeping in mind when I'm trying to decide how to go about that?
There are two questions you have to ask yourself that will help you decide what your digital body language signals will be. K, OK, exclamation points, you name it. The first is, who has more or less power? If you have more power in that Slack conversation, you actually have an opportunity to create more informality. You could write, you know, OK with exclamation points and a smiley face signaling excitement or interest. Or you could just write OK, maybe signaling that you're typing quickly and you're brief and to the point. Now, if you have less power, it may be better to err on the side of formality and then grow that informality of a relationship over time. You may want to write okay with a period, very firm business language. Now, the second question you have to answer is, how much do you trust each other? Are you longtime colleagues that have worked together for 5 years, or have you met 5 days ago? And this will also shape how formal or informal you are. Now, research shows that we even tend to use punctuation signals differently. In fact, one study showed when a woman used multiple exclamations, it often signaled excitement. But when a man used them, it often signaled urgency. So not only do we need to be conscious of trust and power, sometimes our signals can be misconstrued simply by our gender or generation.
Exclamation points are especially tricky, I think. And I interact with people who are older than me and also people who are quite younger than me on instant messaging. And I have noticed a difference in the way exclamation points are used. Would you talk us through, there's a chart you have in the book about how many exclamation points to use and sort of when you're into dangerous territory. And it's tricky. What does one exclamation point typically signal? When would I just use one exclamation point?
So, you know, most importantly, exclamation points are really a reframe of the signals of our face, raised eyebrows or a tapping of a finger. And so the more we use them, the more dramatic it is. So one exclamation point may just be basic enthusiasm. You know, this is great.
And just to translate that, so if I think to myself, all right, if I were sitting face to face with this person and if I were like nodding like, yeah, great, let's do it. if that were my reaction.
With a, you know, an inflection of your voice or a raised eyebrow.
Okay.
Right.
One exclamation point is probably good for that.
One exclamation point. Now, if you start to use two or three, Julie, this can be two things. It can either show a lot of excitement or it can begin to show it, some type of sarcasm or even potentially anger. For example, if something is delayed, you know, and you need to write an email saying, we need this now, you may use three exclamation points to show you're a little frustrated. We need this now. You know, if you're excited and showing gratitude, you may write thank you in a Slack message with three exclamation points showing excitement. So a lot of this does come with context. But when you get to maybe 4 to 6 exclamation points, I think usually it's much more of urgency or it's really deep excitement with those that have high trust with one another. So if you're emailing your boss, you may want to err on the side of, you know, 2 to 3 max, maybe not 4 to 6, unless you have a high trust relationship. And when we go back to the gender dynamic, research actually shows that women feel more pressure to use multiple exclamation points compared to men because they feel like they often need to soften their messages. Similar to up-talking and voice pitch, we actually see the rise of using these digital cues in a similar way.
And is it different depending on age? Or is it just me that I feel like as a mid-40-something that exclamation points are to be used sparingly. And if you hit me with more than one or two, I think you're being fake or over the top or inauthentic somehow.
Yeah, research does show, especially younger employees, those that tended to grow up as digital natives, where exclamation points were a part of their lingo in high school, you know, tend to use them more often, but they tend to be judged more for using multiple exclamation points versus those that are older. My general rule of thumb is think before you exclamation point, right? Be thoughtful of the trust and power dynamic. You may use them, you know, very proactively with a group of friends, but with your new boss, be careful.
So we've talked a little bit about how to convey excitement through an exclamation point. Are there other ways to convey the sense that you're like leaning in and you're fully engaged, but you're doing this only in writing?
Yeah. So not only are emojis and exclamation points useful, but capitalization is such a powerful way to show a level of excitement.
Wait, you mean all caps? You mean like typing
all caps messages? You know, thank you so much, or you know, we're ready for you, right? These are simple messages that can show a level of excitement. At the same time, capitalization can also seem like shouting. So there's a double-edged sword on that. A couple of other examples of excitement could be really quick response times, responding within 2 minutes or 2 hours, say if it's an email, or sending multiple messages in a row without getting a response first. Maybe sending an email saying, this is great, and then sending a text saying, I'm really excited about what you did, and using multiple channels to show that eagerness.
Wow. I want to go back to the difference you said between email and text in how fast you respond. So responding within 2 hours to an email would be considered enthusiastic. But if it's a text or like a Slack message, it needs to be within 2 minutes.
Let's say, 10 minutes, maybe not 2 minutes. We all have things to do. But what is true is that when it comes to digital body language, there are different implied response time expectations depending on the channel. Text is faster than email. Setting up a video call is slower than maybe an email response. And so when we send off things, there's usually an expected norm that makes or breaks how we interpret, if it's excitement, anger, frustration, or happiness.
Which emojis are appropriate in a work scenario where you've, let's say with your boss, who you know pretty well, but still they're your boss. Would you ever use emojis in that case?
I think that my answer 3 or 4 years ago was completely different to today, where remote work is here to stay. And the loss of nonverbal cues has allowed us to use emojis to value others, to create intimate connections, even from behind a screen. My general rule of thumb is I think that it's incredibly useful to use emojis, but similarly, think before you emoji. If you're a leader, you can use the smiley face emoji, the happy emoji, the celebration emoji, or just your own creative ones. Maybe stay away from, say, the purple eggplant, but most of the other ones that show excitement or positive emotions, I think are, part of the etiquette now of how incorporations of communicating positive emotions. However, I think it's always important to be conscious of those two questions I shared, trust and power. If there's high trust, it's great to use them to signal cues. If there's low trust, err on the side of formality first. And if you have a higher power level, you can actually use emojis to build more emotional connection, especially with those digital natives that can't read your body language anymore and want to know whether they really did good work or not. And when you just write thanks, period, at the end of an email, they don't really know if it was good or not. But that thanks with an emoji, that smiley face emoji, can actually signal something better for them.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the things that struck me the most here. I tend to be a person who I'd rather just type fast and not worry about punctuation or spelling or even spell checking. Or I'm just like, the content of what I'm saying matters most, right? And I'll respond quickly, but I'm not necessarily going to think about all this other stuff that feels like fluff that you have to attach to it. And the thing I get from your book is that it's not fluff. Like, you have to think about emojis and exclamation points and capitalization in order to make sure that you're actually hitting the mark. What are some of the ways in which you see people most commonly missing the mark, going wrong when it comes to digital communication?
There are three common mistakes I see. The first is confusing a brief message with a clear message. Brevity can create a lot of confusion. If you send a message saying, we need to talk, ... and you're a senior leader sending it to someone you don't know well, they may think they're about to get fired. We have to remember that many of our messages can seem ambiguous and become anxiety producing. So just taking that extra moment to think before you type can go a long way. Secondly, another thing that's important is just to avoid the slow or no responses. We all get hundreds of messages that we just can't respond to. But for our team, where there's high trust, where there's a commitment, really being thoughtful around it, others can make meanings out of it. And it can actually reduce some of the trust we're trying to build. And then the third thing that I think is important, which really goes beyond just our written communication, is to avoid multitasking. We are on our computers all the time in video meetings. And in many ways, less haste equals more speed. Reading messages carefully is the new listening. Writing clearly is the new empathy. And making sure you're really being present in your video meetings really makes or breaks trust in our modern day age.
When you're trying to maintain trust in a relationship, how do you handle a message that you need to take some time to respond to? So then you might leave them waiting for a day because you're so slammed, but you really want to circle back to it. How do you not send the wrong message by sort of leaving them feel like they're hanging?
Well, I think the first thing to do that you said beautifully, Julie, is pause don't respond, especially maybe if you're triggered or you need, or it's complex and you need to think about it. Don't react or rush a response. Wait. You know, a couple things you can do. Number one, you can respond to them if they need a quick response and say, got it, I'll get back to you Tuesday, as a great way to just set the tone that you're on it, but you need more time. Secondly, if it's not going to be too long, you know, draft something. And then if you know that you need to be in a better mood before you hit send, sleep on it overnight, you know, ask a peer to review it, especially if you're dealing with a passive aggressive type of scenario. And last but not least, always ask yourself, should I pick up the phone instead? If this is a complex discussion, remember that there are certain things that get lost in written communication. And in many ways, I like to say picking up the phone is worth 1,000 emails. So knowing when to switch the channel is also a signal of good digital body language.
Finally, Erica Dewan, would you talk for a moment about the idea of a digital persona, that we all have one? Like, what goes into it? And also, what is the risk when you veer from your digital persona or what people are expecting of you?
In many ways, we've all learned that we don't just have our traditional brand that was really built on our office communications and our face-to-face meetings. Whether we like it or not, we have an identity online. I'll give you an example. Before I hire anyone, whether it's a babysitter or a new marketing leader for my team, I Google them. And most employers do this. They really react to the first impression we show the world that is online. So what are the elements of a digital persona? Even simple things that are important to be thinking about now. Your name. When someone Googles you, is it clear how they can find you? Your history across social media, across different channels. Your email address. Even simple things like, do you have a Yahoo, Hotmail, Earthlink, or Gmail account? These simple things can signal to others your style. You know, I know one leader who said, I would never hire someone who has an Earthlink email account. They just seem out of date. And I'm sharing this because we may think, you know, it is funny, but we do have subconscious judgments of others based on their digital persona. Your profile picture. Do you have a picture of a sunset or is it a thoughtful picture of you? These are things that can signal executive presence or not. And even search results. Have you been conscious of what are the three websites that come up with your name? Whether you like it or not, they matter.
Erica Dewan is a speaker and author on management communication and collaboration. And her latest book is Digital Body Language. Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, caffeine can perk you up, but can it really compensate for a lack of sleep? It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Julie Rose. How well can a dose of caffeine compensate for lack of sleep? Psychology professor Kimberly Fenn at Michigan State University is a sleep researcher, and she's been looking lately at this question, at the role caffeine can play for people who are sleep deprived. Professor Fenn, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. All right, anybody who's consumed caffeine knows that it can perk you up, make you feel a little more energized. How is it doing that? How exactly does caffeine increase your energy?
Yeah, so as you remain awake, there's a chemical that builds up in your brain called adenosine. And what caffeine does is essentially counteracts adenosine. So adenosine essentially makes you sleepy. And so caffeine almost has like a double negative here. It stops making you sleepy. So you feel more awake, you feel more alert. You know, most of us drink a cup of coffee or two in the morning. And, you know, the benefits of caffeine are really well established.
Okay. So it makes you feel less sleepy. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's doing everything that a good night's sleep would do for you.
That's correct. And it absolutely is not doing everything that a good night's sleep can do for you.
Let's talk about that then. So what does sleep do for you besides make you feel less sleepy?
Well, sleep has essentially wide-ranging and pervasive effects on physiology and cognitive performance. So, you know, any one of us who grew up in the 90s, you know, are used to that phrase, right? I'll sleep when I'm dead. But it turns out that our bodies require sleep. It's, you know, just as critical to our survival and to our health and well-being as, you know, proper nutrition and exercise would be. So we need sleep. And in fact, you know, there have been studies on different rodent models to suggest that if animals don't get sleep, they die. And although humans, you know, would never go without sleep for very long, essentially your body would just shut down. There is a rare disease called fatal familial insomnia, where people actually lose the ability to sleep. It's extremely, extremely rare. It only affects about 40 families across the world. But in these individuals who are afflicted with this disease, every single person who's been diagnosed with it has died within a year or a year and a half of disease onset.
Wait, so why would not
absolutely
why would not sleeping kill you? Like how would it kill you?
Well, that is a good question. In the rodent model, one way that they think it's operating is that your body isn't able to essentially keep itself alive. It's not able to maintain its body weight. So in the rodents, the animals that weren't sleeping, that they artificially kept awake, would eat, you know, more and more food, but they couldn't maintain body weight. And one of the ways, or one of the adverse effects, is that they essentially were malnourished and starving. Exactly how it works, I don't actually know. But the important thing just to remember is that there are lots of things that happen while you sleep that are critical for the body and the brain.
Okay. Something that's going on that's restorative. We know that sleep is when some memories get sort of cemented, right, into your long-term memory.
Correct.
And so if caffeine is making it so that you're not as sleepy, what is it not doing for you? So a person who's sleep deprived, and I know you tested this with people in a laboratory, and I always feel bad for anybody who goes to a sleep lab and agrees to be kept up for days or whatever. But what do you find in someone who hasn't had enough sleep? What can they and can't they do if they are sufficiently caffeinated?
Yeah. So I think before I tell you about what we did, I think it's important to remember that when a person is sleep deprived, their brain is in essentially an entire different state. So essentially, if we look at the brain of a person who is sleep deprived, we show a general reduction in neural activity. And in general, that's not something you want. And we find that people particularly show a reduction in areas in the frontal lobe, which is important for things like executive processing, strategizing, like, you know, it's sort of the part of your brain that helps you do a Sudoku puzzle. And also in areas in the brain that are important for creating memory. So in general, there's, you know, just a dramatic change in neural function. And that is usually related to reductions in performance on a wide range of tasks. Now, in a study that we conducted, we were interested in the difference between sort of lower level or easier cognitive processing and more higher level cognitive processing. So we had our participants do a lower level attention task, which is very simple. So essentially you stare at a computer screen, you press a button when a red dot appears, very simple. And a more higher level placekeeping task. And now in the placekeeping task, essentially participants just had to follow a series of steps. So anything, which is similar to a whole bunch of things you do in your daily life. So it's similar to like following a recipe or going through like a maintenance procedure or, you know, troubleshooting, you know, your Wi-Fi that isn't working or something like this. So you go through a series of steps and it's important that you go through them in a specific order and that you don't repeat one or you don't skip a step. And so what we found is that after sleep deprivation, caffeine was really effective in boosting performance on that super easy, simple task where you just have to monitor the screen. But it had essentially no effect on this more complex, more difficult, we call it like an upper level or higher level cognitive task, the placekeeping task. And I think this is really important because it suggests that individuals who are sleep deprived, if they're monitoring their performance on, you know, really simple stuff, they might find they have no trouble. They have no trouble sending a text to a friend or, you know, answering the phone. But if you put them in front of a wheel of a car, have them do something a little more complicated, they may show deficits, but be essentially unaware that they are impaired from the sleep deprivation.
Yeah, well, that's especially worrisome then, because there are people, I've met people who feel like they are fully capable of doing everything that they need or want to do with less sleep so long as they have caffeine, right?
Yes.
That there is this sense that maybe it doesn't feel as good. I mean, a good night's rest will always feel better than being like highly caffeinated. But in terms of like your ability to get things done, you know, and some people even feel like they're better because of that. But you're finding that when it comes to more complicated tasks, it's just not true. Caffeine just can't replace sleep.
Exactly. 100%. And, you know, again, oftentimes when people are performing sleep or tasks under conditions of sleep deprivation, these are people we don't want making mistakes, right? You know, surgeons, police officers, air traffic controllers, you know, these are people, you know, wherein, you know, errors are rare to begin with, but they can be catastrophic.
Speaking with Kimberly Fenn, who is a professor of psychology and director of the Sleep and Learning Lab at Michigan State University. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll be right back. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Back now with Kimberly Fenn, a professor of psychology and director of the Sleep and Learning Lab at Michigan State University. So, Professor Fenn, how sleep deprived do I need to be in order for caffeine to not be enough to compensate, right? How sleep deprived are we talking here?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm willing to actually give you a number of hours because that could come back to haunt me at some point.
What do you call sleep deprived? How sleep deprived are the people in your study?
So people in our study were sleep deprived for 24 hours, meaning that at the time at which they performed their tasks, they had been awake for a full 24 hours.
Okay.
However, when we think of sleep deprivation, we essentially assume that sleep deprivation starts essentially any time that you're awake past your habitual bedtime. So, for example, if you are really well regimented and you go to bed every night at 11 p.m., you know, by midnight, you have 1 hour of sleep deprivation.
Okay. So you don't really care about total hours that I sleep? Because if I wake up every morning at 5 a.m., but I'm going to bed at 11, you know.
So. Oh, we do. Yeah. So there are two ways that we refer to sleep deprivation in the scientific literature. So we talk about sleep deprivation, which is getting zero sleep for some amount of time. So in our particular study, it was zero sleep for exactly 24 hours. Mm. And these studies go up to things like 88 hours, which is kind of crazy to imagine being awake that long. But the other component of this is something called chronic sleep restriction. So chronic sleep restriction occurs anytime a person gets insufficient sleep on multiple nights. And so that could be anything from, you know, 5, 4, or even 6 hours a night per night. And so what we say is that if that happens for multiple nights in a row, essentially what you do is you build up what we call sleep debt. So if you only get 6 hours of sleep, you know, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, then by the time you go to sleep on Thursday, you've already accumulated 6 hours of sleep debt because you've essentially lost out on 2 hours of sleep per night. And the interesting finding there is that, you know, across a wide range of studies, what people have found is that, you know, 2 or 3 nights of insufficient sleep, so 5 or 6 hours, essentially has cognitive and physiological harm or deficits that are equivalent to 1 night with zero sleep.
Wow.
So I think this is important, yeah, because a lot of Americans, and this is true across the world, but a lot of, you know, go throughout their work week building up sleep debt. And, you know, they think they're fine because, you know, they've had 5 or 6 hours and, you know, you can wake up, you can go about your day, you can get everything done that needs to happen. But what you don't realize is that your underlying physiology is compromised and your cognition is compromised. But you just don't even realize it because, you know, these things are subtle enough that you're just not picking up on the cues necessarily.
And you may be also compensating with some caffeine in some form or other, which makes you feel at least masking because you've got some of the energy, but it's masking potentially the other effects of lack of sleep.
Yes, exactly right.
Kimberly Fenn is a professor of psychology. She directs the Sleep and Learning Lab at Michigan State University. Thank you very much for your time today, Professor Fenn.
Thank you so much for having me.
Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Sierra Hewlett, and Kyle Raymond produce the show. Wishing you a good night's sleep whenever that comes for you. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First, the surprisingly unromantic science of attraction. Then, the U.S. military says no one was killed when white military police clashed with black soldiers one night in Louisiana during World War II. But the black community in that town say people did die, and the military covered it up. We'll hear about an effort to uncover the truth. Also, the Fountain of Youth may be your local swimming pool. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for joining us. The streaming websites have been putting a new kind of dating show on the map to test how important looks are when people fall in love. There's one where participants get to know each other without ever meeting in person until they have accepted a marriage proposal. There's another where people wear elaborate masks and makeup to obscure their faces during the first couple of dates. Now, of course, we've all heard stories of couples who say they weren't really attracted until they got to know each other and then something clicked. Is that real? How much do looks matter in love? Viren Swamy is a professor of social psychology at Anglia Ruskin University and author of Attraction Explained, The Science of How We Form Relationships. He's with me now. Professor Swamy, thanks for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Is it just the shallow people who care about looks?
I would say that most people care about looks, even though they may not want to vocalize that. In very simple terms, I mean, imagine you saw someone for the first time. You don't have any information about them. You don't have any information about their background, about their sense of humor, about their grammatical prowess. And all you really have to go on, if you're sighted, is what they look like. And often we're kind of biased in our perceptions of people based on what we see initially.
Okay, so looks always matter, but is there a universal definition of what looks good on some basic level?
Not especially. So what looks good is often subjective, and it can be based on things like your past experiences, your past relationships, your individual preferences. And there's going to be a lot of variability. Within most societies, there are essentially what we call appearance standards or appearance ideals, which suggest that people who approximate those ideals are going to be perceived as more attractive. But even within that, individuals vary a great deal in what they find attractive.
Give me an example of that. What is it primarily based on culture, or is there some sort of genetic wiring that might make one person find one thing attractive and another person not?
So an evolutionary psychologist would argue that we are the inheritors of our ancestors' genetic endowment. And in evolutionary history, there might have been certain body types or facial features that would have been perceived more attractive. The basic argument from evolutionary psychology is that certain facial features, for example, symmetry, would be a signal of better health. And so we should naturally find those features more attractive. Myself, I'm primarily a social psychologist. I'm interested in the social, I'm interested in the culture, and cultures vary in what they perceive to be attractive and how they negotiate, how they manage, how they define who is attractive and why they're attractive. As a very simple example, body size is one of the best indicators of attractiveness. In most urban societies, what you'll find is that thinner people are generally perceived as more attractive. But if you go to contexts of low socioeconomic status, what you often find is that individuals who are heavier are often perceived as more attractive, because in those societies, body size or heavier body size was often an indicator of access to food, access to resources, which may be relatively scarce in those areas.
So you would find a heavier body attractive because that person could potentially provide better for you?
they could potentially have better access to resources. And if you live in a society that's relatively deprived, you want access to resources. But even then, it's complicated. I'll give you a simple example of this. We conducted a study many, many years ago in South Africa in a place called KwaZulu-Natal. KwaZulu-Natal at the time had one of the highest incidences of HIV and AIDS. Now, one of the kind of outcomes or one of the markers of HIV is that you lose body weight very quickly. You become emaciated. So in KwaZulu-Natal, there was additional pressure to avoid people who looked overly skinny because they would have probably had HIV or AIDS.
Huh. And so body size and face, are those the two sort of primary components of how humans define attractiveness?
I tend to avoid talking about humans in terms of their component parts. I tend to prefer talking about humans as a whole. I mean, when we see someone for the first time, we're taking in all the information we can, all the visual information that's available. And that includes what they look like facially, but also what their body size might look like, but also what they're wearing, their hair color, their style, their body movement, all kinds of different things go into that initial perception.
How long does it continue to matter as you get more information about an individual? Does it start to matter more or less? Does your perception change?
Well, what we do know by asking people is that the importance of physical appearance probably matters most at first sight. As soon as social interaction begins, and by social interaction, I simply mean two people having a conversation or two people engaging with each other, the importance of physical appearance drops off quite dramatically. And other things start to become more important, what we call non-physical traits. We can talk about that if you like. But if the relationship progresses in either a sexual or romantic direction, then physical or the importance of physical appearance might increase again. Not necessarily to the same levels as at first sight, but certainly it's an important ingredient of romantic relationships.
So you'd be more likely to approach them for any kind of a relationship. Is that fair to say? Friendly, maybe potentially for a romantic relationship?
Yeah.
Okay.
So most human beings have a bias. It's called the what is good is beautiful bias. We are biased to perceive or to think of people who are physically attractive as having all kinds of wonderful personal qualities. We think they're happier. We think they're more popular. We think they're more sociable. We think they're going to be more successful at life. So we have a natural tendency to kind of misperceive people who are physically attractive as having all these wonderful personal qualities, which means we're much more likely to want to engage them in any kind of relationship, whether it's a friendship, a work relationship, or even a romantic relationship. Now, the problem is that once you get to know someone, other things start to matter as well, whether you are similar in terms of your values, for example, or how warm and personable they are, their sense of humor. And then once you've got that information, all those other bits of information begin to become more important in determining whether or not you want to have a relationship with that person. Now, as I said, in the longer term, if that relationship is progressing or seems to be progressing in a sexual or romantic direction, we would expect the importance of physical appearance to increase again. In very simple terms, we all want to perceive our partners as physically attractive.
Are you saying that someone, that your perception of their physical attractiveness changes, like they become more physically attractive to you than you even perceived them initially?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the kind of big fallacies of physical attractiveness is that it's a static trait. As a very simple example, say the first time you meet me, you think I'm a 5 out of 10. The kind of assumption here is that I'm always going to be a 5 out of 10. But what we know from psychology is that those perceptions and those rating, that kind of offhand rating, a 5 out of 10 of me, could change. Simply put, if, for example, you think I'm a 5 out of 10 initially and we begin to have a conversation, you think I'm a warm person, you think I'm honorable, you think I'm a decent human being, your perceptions of my non-physical characteristics could also influence how you view me physically. So that 5 out of 10 might become an 8 out of 10 simply because you perceive me as being warm and a good person. So it influences how you perceive me physically. We call it a halo bias. And another thing's also happening in kind of short-term relationships. Once we enter into a relationship, we also seem to be biased into thinking that our partners are more physically attractive than they actually are. It's almost like we're kind of putting on these glasses, and these glasses make our partners seem more attractive than they really are. I've called it the lover's blind bias. And it's simply a tendency for most people to think not just that their partners are more attractive than themselves, but also more attractive than would objective observers, so people who have no information of your partner.
And why is that happening?
What we think is that in part it helps you invest in the relationship. If you think your partner is more physically attractive than you, you think you're doing well for yourself, but also you kind of tend to want to invest more in that relationship and make sure that relationship doesn't falter.
So you mentioned that someone who I initially perceive as a 5 on the scale of 1 to 10 in physical attractiveness, we get to know each other, and then maybe I actually see that person as an 8. Is personality and sense of humor and similar interests, is that ever going to take someone from a 1 to a 10 in my attractiveness perception?
I think probably it wouldn't be so dramatic. Okay. I think what it does, it provides the kind of the basis for a strong, stable relationship. Most people tend to want to be in relationships, at least when we're talking about long-term relationships. Most people want to be in relationships with other people. I don't know if this is an American term, a kind of a good egg. We want someone who is decent. We want someone who is fun, romantic, someone who is honest and communicative, a good listener, all those kind of nice qualities about a person. Now, that might take a 1 to maybe a 4 or a 5, but in the absence of physical attractiveness and being attracted to the other person, it's not going to be a kind of the key to a romantic relationship.
So what do you think scientifically, Professor Swamy, is going on when people say, oh, you know, when I first met my husband, I didn't think he was handsome at all. And, you know, 2 years later, we'd been hanging out in the same friend group and we'd become good friends. And then all of a sudden I was madly in love with him and we got married. what do you really think is going on? What is that story actually?
I think partly it is a function of the fact that most people don't have good awareness into what they actually want or what they wanted. Again, most people might say, look, I've got this type. I like this person or this kind of person who might be tall, dark and handsome or whatever it is. But actually, in reality, not everyone is going to fall into this kind of tall, dark, handsome category. And so we make compromises here and there. We kind of say, well, maybe they're not so tall, but I still like them anyway. And we might like them for all kinds of other reasons that we're not completely aware of. Our own personal baggage, the kind of stuff we bring into relationships, our relationships with our parents or caregivers, our relationships with past partners, all affect how we view other people now. So in the first instance, people might construct these narratives about how they view their own relationships. And they might have a kind of explanation for what it was like or what it might be like, which may not reflect reality. The other possibility is that, of course, things like non-physical characteristics become much more important over time. And one of the things we know from psychology is that beyond non-physical characteristics, every relationship is what we call a dyad. Takes two people within that relationship. And one of the key ingredients for the kind of long-term relationship stability is what we call reciprocity. And there's a specific kind of reciprocity that seems to be really important. It's called reciprocal self-disclosure. So reciprocal self-disclosure is where we begin to exchange intimate information about one another. As a simple example, if I'm having a conversation with you, I might say, look, I really like dogs and dogs are my favorite animals. I love them to bits. And you might share something about yourself. Now, me telling you that I like dogs isn't particularly intimate. But when we start to talk about things like our mental health or our fantasies or our secrets, and we begin to share that kind of information, we're engaging in reciprocal self-disclosure. And that seems to be a really key ingredient, a key building block for relationship formation.
Speaking with Viren Swamy, who's a professor of social psychology at Anglia Ruskin University in the UK, author of Attraction Explained, The Science of How We Form Relationships. What are the other non-physical components that can lead to a relationship forming?
The one that no one ever thinks about is geography. Geography is one of the best predictors of whether or not two people will form any kind of relationship. What we know is that the greater the physical distance between two people, the less likely it is to form any kind of relationship. And we know this because of wonderful work that was done by a professor of sociology, James Bossard, in Philadelphia back in the 1930s. Essentially, what you can imagine in 1930s Philadelphia, James Bossard went and measured the distance that two people lived before they got married. So if you lived in Philadelphia in the 1930s, you wanted to get married, you had to go to the marriage registry office and you'd ask for a license and you'd have to provide your address and the address of your partner. Now, you use that to measure how far apart people were living before they got married. And what you found was that most people tended to marry someone who ended up living relatively nearby. In fact, about 4% of people in Philadelphia in the 1930s married someone who lived in the same block as themselves. The majority married someone who lived no more than about 20 blocks from each other. Now, obviously, 1930s Philadelphia might be a very different world today, but we're still finding the same basic effect today.
Even with internet dating and, you know,
even with internet dating, the greater the physical distance between two people, the less likely they are to form any kind of relationship.
So you've got geography, so proximity, physical proximity, and reciprocity, which is another one that you mentioned. And then we've talked about attraction. Is one of those three more important than the others?
It's a really difficult question to answer because there's no way of really comparing. I tend to think of geography as the kind of the thing that brings people into the same space at the same time, but it's no guarantee that people will form a relationship. Likewise, physical appearance might be the thing that attracts you to someone, but again, it's no guarantee that you're going to form a relationship. Non-physical characteristics matter as well, but in the longer term, reciprocity probably becomes slightly more important. I guess the kind of bottom line here is that I am not in the game of trying to predict in advance when two or more people will form any kind of relationship. And the reason for that's very simple. It's impossible. Some people might like to think they have some special powers to predict that two people are going to be good for each other, but life is far too messy. Psychology is far too messy to be able to predict anything in advance in that form, at least in terms of relationships. Even the best computer scientists, when you kind of add all the information you have about two people together, they're not able to predict with any degree of accuracy whether or not two people will form any kind of relationship. And the likelihood here is that there are all kinds of factors that are impossible to predict in real life. I'll give you a very simple example of this. Say we go and have a conversation in a bar or a pub. There is no way in advance you could predict if I might spill my drink and that might ruin the day. Or you can't predict in advance whether you might find me unattractive because I look like your dad. And those kinds of things are very subjective, very individual, but they also reflect the messiness of real life. So trying to predict in advance whether or not a relationship will be satisfying or whether or not be successful is impossible. And in the same way, it's not really fruitful to ask whether one factor is going to be more important than another.
Are you able to identify the components, though, that would make for long-term success, a relationship that might last 40 years?
What we can do is kind of talk about the processes that are involved. So we've talked about some of the things already. We've talked about physical appearance. We've talked about non-physical characteristics, geography, reciprocity. The other one we haven't talked about is similarity. And similarity seems to be really key in terms of long-term relationship stability. When people are similar in terms of their demographics, but more importantly, when they're similar in terms of their life values, what they consider to be important in their lives, things like music, their politics, their degree of wanting to have or not wanting to have children, those kind of things seem to matter most in terms of predicting or kind of at least facilitating long-term relationship stability.
Viren Swamy is a professor of social psychology at Anglia Ruskin University, author of Attraction Explained, The Science of How We Form Relationships. Professor Swamy, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 20 minutes, swimming is not just good exercise. It's also great for your brain. Just ahead, the attempt to solve an historical mystery about a confrontation between black soldiers and white military police in Louisiana during World War II. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This year, the city of Alexandria, Louisiana, installed an historical marker commemorating a confrontation between African-American soldiers and white military police during World War II. It's become known as the Lee Street Riot of 1942. But the story passed down through generations of black Americans in that town is that it was more of a massacre than a riot. They say unarmed black soldiers in training, ready to deploy overseas, were attacked by armed military police during a night out in Alexandria, Louisiana. According to the official military account of the event, nobody died in the confrontation. But there are other accounts that allege dozens of black soldiers were killed and that the U.S. military covered up those deaths. Douglas Bristol is a professor of history at the University of Southern Mississippi. He studies the experience of black soldiers in the U.S. military, and he is researching the Lee Street Riot. Professor Bristol, hello. Thanks for your time today.
Hello, Julie. Thanks for having me.
How can there be any doubt if people died or did not die the night of this confrontation? If soldiers were killed, their families would have been told about that, wouldn't they?
They would have been told, but it's not necessarily clear that they would have been told the actual reason that their son died. There are other instances of where Black soldiers died in suspicious circumstances and Black witnesses, you know, said something else happened, and the military just comes up with a plausible excuse, injured in a training exercise, that it means we should give credibility to the oral histories of this riot.
Oh, so there are proven instances in which the military was
lied.
lied about how a Black soldier died.
That's correct.
Okay. Which is one reason why considering the oral histories matters here. So tell us what we know factually, if anything at all, about what took place. Give us a little bit of the story as we know it today.
Well, according to the children of eyewitnesses of what happened that night, as well as Black reporters who went from New Orleans, went to the scene immediately, as well as local officials in the NAACP who wrote to the War Department. So those are people that were on site. This all happened on January 30th, 1942. Lee Street was the Black business district in Alexandria. And like any typical weekend, Alexandria was surrounded by three military bases, Camps Livingston, Claiborne, and Polk. As many as 30,000 soldiers would come into this town, which is only about 50,000 at that point, for a little off-duty recreation. They're there to drink in bars, get haircuts, watch movies. And a Black soldier was crossing the street in front of the Ritz movie theater, a Black-owned movie theater, when a white woman driver honked at him. And according to James LaForce, the newspaper reporter and NAACP official in New Orleans, who went to the scene afterwards and interviewed people, the Black GI asked the white woman, would you run over a soldier? She responded by calling a city policeman who arrested the Black GI for using vile and unnecessary languages. A group of Black GIs thought this was an unnecessary arrest and crowded around the white policeman. And in very short order, and the inspector general's report from the military confirms that very shortly, this white Alexandria policeman was backed up quickly by military policemen, but also by state troopers and National Guardsmen from nearby Camp Beauregard. And instead of restoring order, these armed white men began what I call in my book a police riot, firing volley after volley of shots into Black-owned businesses on Lee Street. LaForce, who visited Alexandria just a matter of days after this happened, reported that Lee Street from 5th Street to 12th Street, quote, became a replica of miniature aerial bombardment, unquote. So he was the one who reported that many eyewitnesses told him 10 Black soldiers were killed. This is what was reported in the Black press. How about someone who was in Alexandria? That would be S. Bradley, who was the president of the Alexandria branch of the NAACP. I found a letter from him he wrote to the War Department at the National Archives, and he described that 5 hours that night as a reign of terror. This is a direct quote. Negro civilians were brutally beaten and intimidated. Negro soldiers were huddled together like cattle and subjected to all kinds of atrocities. Bradley went so far as to say, quote, there's a striking parallel between the Gestapo of Nazi Germany and the white military and civilian police of Alexandria. In addition,
and the Black soldiers, to be clear here, tell us a little more about who these Black soldiers were. They were unarmed. This was their night off in town. They were in training as members of the U.S. military to deploy overseas, right, to World War II.
Well, actually, most of them were in training to be in service forces. The military had concluded that Black men lacked the intelligence to be good combat soldiers. So only 20% of African-Americans in the military were trained, were put in combat units. And that number even dwindled as overseas deployment began. So they're in training. The real issue is they are Black men, many of them from the North, who have been placed in the Deep South, where white civilians are alarmed by the very sight of a Black man in uniform and feared that this would somehow threaten the status of the Jim Crow system.
Why were they sent into the Deep South, into the segregated South, for training in Louisiana?
There are practical reasons. You can train year-round in the South because it's warm. There are also very powerful congressmen from the South who are very eager to have military bases in the South because, of course, the Depression really hasn't ended yet. So early on in mobilization, there's a desire to get as many military facilities as possible located in your congressional district.
And was a flare-up of racial tension between the white citizens and the white police in this town and the Black soldiers who were there for training, was a flare-up like this unusual?
That's an excellent question, Julie. I've gone through all the letters that Black citizens wrote to there was one official in the War Department whose job it was to look out for the well-being of Black soldiers, the civilian aide to the Secretary of War. And going through those letters, I've come across hundreds of incidences that are similar, maybe not in scope, but in terms of the violence that's involved here. Daniel Kreider looked through military records where they officially recognized riots and found 59 incidents in 1942.
So it would not at all have been unusual that, a white citizen would have been upset or offended by something that a Black man, a Black soldier said, and that would sort of, but this clearly escalated beyond other incidents that took place at that time, as far as we know. And how did the U.S. military, if the military covered it up, as the eyewitness accounts would suggest, what did they do with the bodies? How did they manage to sort of control the narrative so strongly?
Well, Haywood Joyner Jr., who is a professor at LSU Alexandria, whose father was a Black GI who was on Lee Street that night, told him that, first off, he told him he thought he was going to die during that event, but he managed to live. And he said afterwards, the military came in, closed off the area, and brought trains in with empty boxcars. In addition, a reporter for the Alexandria Town Talk, their local newspaper, talked to a Black undertaker in 2000 who said that the military contacted him to get coffins.
Okay.
So easily they could have loaded up men in coffins on rail cars and moved them. There's literally thousands of acres on nearby military bases where they could have been disposed of.
Disposed of?
Hidden in mass graves.
I know that you've been involved in attempting to locate any mass graves. Are there any potentially suspicious places where the bodies of these men might reside?
Well, back in the spring, my colleague David Holt, who's a geographer who has a specialty of using ground penetrating radar in graveyards where the headstones have been misplaced when trying to identify bodies, went with me with some graduate students. And the challenge was, because of the poverty of the Black population in central Louisiana, many people simply couldn't afford a headstone. So if you go, we went to the Black cemetery in Alexandria, which is located across the river in Pineville, and found many graves that were unmarked. So that was not conclusive. He said, really, he felt he needed to find a number of bodies lined up in a trench before he could say there was a mass grave. In addition, I want to remind you the possibility I brought up in the first place. They could have very well sent people home and simply attributed some other explanation. They were accidentally shot in a live ammunition training exercise. Mm.
And if that were the case, would there even be any record of this in U.S. government archives that might once and for all, find the truth about this?
That's a really interesting prospect. unfortunately, since I became aware of this, the National Archives has been closed during due to COVID. Mm. But one thing I would like to go back to do is they do have each unit of the military files weekly reports that involves their muster roles. So I think it'd be fairly simple to go back because we know which units, Black units, were based in that area, and look to see if a large number of men go missing from the rosters of the muster rolls.
And so you would say, okay, here's the timing. Even though the military might have said it was a friendly fire accident, if you could narrow down the timing to this January night in 1942 in these particular units, you might be able to.
Right. I mean, so if men suddenly go missing from the muster rolls, where'd they go?
Right. Why would the War Department, if it did, why would they have felt the need to cover up this? This is a time in America in the 1940s when, I mean, their lynching happened. It seems like the War Department could have acknowledged that this was a race riot gone wrong. And I don't know that that would have raised that many eyebrows in America at the time.
Well, I mean, that's a good context for thinking about the times of race relations were not good. However, most people remember World War II as the last war we fought with segregated troops. Most people don't realize this was the first war where the government had promised Black men they would be treated without discrimination within the context of a segregated military. And they didn't do this just out of principle. They did this because President Roosevelt, when he's running in 1940 for an unprecedented third term, was afraid he was going to lose the Black vote. And this issue of the treatment of Black soldiers just as they were passing the peacetime draft became a real issue in the campaign. Mm-hmm. So he made some unprecedented promises. And he did things like appoint that official I mentioned, the civilian aide to the Secretary of War. So there's political reasons why the administration fears angering Black voters, because as they grew in the North, they became the swing vote in presidential elections.
I'm speaking with Douglas Bristol, who is a history professor at the University of Southern Mississippi. Were there international concerns that would have led the United States to want to downplay something like this happening in its own military at this moment in time?
That's also a factor. Both historians John Dower and Takashi Fujitani said that the Pacific War in World War II became a battle for the hearts and minds of the peoples living in Southeast Asia. The Japanese had promised to liberate people from European colonialism and to give them equality and prosperity. And so part of decisions made about, for example, deploying some Black units was for propaganda value to counter what the Japanese were saying. In addition, the Japanese actually targeted Black troops who were stationed in the Pacific with propaganda that said, essentially, why are you fighting a white man's war when it's not going to change your status a bit?
Mm. Talk to us a bit, if you would, about the experience of Black soldiers in the U.S. military at this time. So they were still in segregated units. And you mentioned also that these Black soldiers in training there in Louisiana were not necessarily destined for more prestigious, positions in the military. Why would they enlist?
They weren't. They were drafted.
Okay.
In 1942, the military stopped accepting volunteers because it was more efficient to conscript people, because they could conscript people. You don't want a diesel mechanic to volunteer for the infantry when you have a shortage of diesel mechanics. So most all soldiers in World War II were drafted, for one. But in terms of understanding kind of a larger picture, it seemed Truman Gibson, one of the civilian aides to the Secretary of War, said there's a paradox about mobilization. On the one hand, they really did train Black soldiers in the regular boot camp and everything you would do to prepare people to be proud soldiers of the U.S. Army. But at the same time, they were told, as he said, to remain in their places in the South. And what does that mean? Well, according to him, he said that meant not walking on sidewalks, not being able to board buses if there are any white people to ride, not possessing any rights, the freedom of physical violence. So the soldiers were being terrorized by white civilians. The military was not protecting them. And they were incredibly angry that they not only couldn't serve in combat, but that they couldn't even be protected while they were in uniform, which explains why there were so many racial clashes.
What did black soldiers gain, if anything, by serving in the military and by the by some of the benefits that were afforded veterans after the war?
Well, that's very suggestive the way you ended that question. Mm-hmm. I argue in the book I'm working on, Behind the Front Lines, How Black GIs Helped Win World War II, that black soldiers gained from the war as individuals, not as a group. Mm. One thing nobody's really discussed, World War II revolutionized warfare because we put everything on wheels. We mechanized things. So infantry could keep up with troops and airplanes. And the military was completely unprepared for the expanded number of service forces they would need or the number of skilled service people they would have. And they turned to black soldiers to fill that gap. So soldiers, black veterans, end up having the skills most sought after in American industry after the war. And there are some studies by sociologists looking at data that found 40% of black veterans left the region of their birth, which was almost entirely the South. So they got out of the Deep South. And as employees, they made more money and had less unemployment than black civilian men who had not served in the military. So they do benefit. Many of them also were able to take advantage of GI benefits.
Douglas Bristol is a professor of history at the University of Southern Mississippi. Thank you for sharing your insight with us today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, the Fountain of Youth may be at your local swimming pool.
Thank you for listening to Top of Mind. I'm Ciara Hewlett. You might want to get in as much swimming as you can before the summer is over because new research is finding that it's super good for your brain. Biologist Sina Matthew even suggests that the legendary Fountain of Youth might just be any old body of water you can take a dip in. Professor Matthew teaches at the University of Mary Hardin Baylor, and she joins me on the line now. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
What are the mental benefits of swimming?
So there are a lot of different benefits to swimming. Some of the big benefits are an improvement in your short as well as your long-term memory formations. We've noticed that there are differences in mental ailments. So the amount of depression and anxiety that a person may feel can decrease over time with regular swimming. And it's also been used in some individuals. It's starting to become a therapy for people who have traumatic brain injury and just repairing the neuronal connections that might be damaged and repairing your brain, essentially.
Wow. It does a lot.
Yes.
Is that just because it's exercise? You know, an exercise is good for you, or is this different from any other? Do we not see that in other types of exercise?
So some of it we do see in other types of aerobic exercise. With swimming, you're seeing an increase in the amount of work that the body as a whole is having to do. So you have this increase in the amount of cardiovascular activity, or the amount that your heart has to work to make sure blood is flowing throughout your body. You're having to, because of that, your body tends to make more vessels to help support all of that blood flow. And in different areas of the brain, there's one area of the brain specifically that's known as the hippocampus, and that area is responsible or involved in learning and memory. And so it's been found that with swimming and also with exercise, you're getting changes in the size of the hippocampus. And there's a certain protein, a neurotrophic factor known as brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And so you get increased amounts of that as well when you have, when you're swimming. And so all of that kind of helps to repair and, you know, increase that brain functioning over time.
Okay. And so because it's using more of the body, working the heart more, that's, it's going to give you more of those benefits than any other type of exercise.
Yeah. So if you're looking at swimming, you're using your heart and you're using your arms and legs and everything, very similar to running, but then you also have this added resistance of the water that you're kind of working against. And so it's thought that might be helping in terms of that brain function. There's also research that has shown that just kind of being in water puts you in this different state. So just kind of being in water and floating in water can help with lowering levels of anxiety. And so then that also going into the water and having that different mental state can also potentially help you later on.
Hmm. I mean, I have noticed it's relaxing to just jump in the water, swim around, float for a bit, you know. But why would that be though? That it'd put you in that different state. What could it be about water that would do that?
So there's a lot of research that looks into that, and that some of it is if you look at. So imagine you're doing a backflow float or like a swimming on your back, or I guess even any type of swimming, you're kind of, when you're in the water, you're blocking out kind of the sounds from the outside. You can have this more kind of meditative mindset and just it kind of be within as opposed to just observing or being outside. Even if you're floating like in an outdoor pool, when you're laying there, you're kind of just staring out in the clouds, right? Mm-hmm. You're not seeing all of the activity that's going on. And so that can kind of help with that relaxation, kind of being outside of the outside, if that
makes
sense.
Do you think that's why it helps specifically with depression and anxiety? Because you're just... it's meditative. You're blocking out the outside world and just in your own little world when you've got that water in your ears.
Yeah. And also, if we're looking at swimming, it's known to increase neurotransmitters and specifically serotonin. And so serotonin is one of the neurotransmitters that's involved with depression and anxiety. And so you get higher levels of that release of serotonin. And so that can also help with the levels of depression, anxiety in terms of lowering your depression.
Why would
you now have more of that release?
Why would it release serotonin?
It releases different types of neurotransmitters, but serotonin is one of the types. You also get endorphins that are released in terms of helping with that euphoric pain releasing sensation. So we have different neurotransmitters that we're releasing, and one of them that has been found is serotonin.
Is that with any exercise, or is that specific to swimming?
That is with any exercise.
Okay. And do you have to do any specific type of swimming to get all these benefits that we've been talking about, like with the memory and all of that? Can you just be treading water? Or do you need to be doing the breaststroke or what is it?
So I think right now we don't know the answer to the specific strokes or anything. And so that's what a lot of research now is looking into, is what is the amount of time that you would need to be in it? How long would you need to be swimming? What type of strokes? There's research that has found breaststroke can help with memory and cognition, freestyle, all different types. But I think we're trying to figure out what is it, or is there a certain stroke that maybe would be better than the other?
I was going to ask next, and you brought it up, is how long? Do we have any idea if you can get these benefits just for going to the pool once, that you'd get a little bit of this, or do you need to be going consistently to start to see these benefits?
I think you do need to go somewhat consistently, but some of the research has shown that you don't necessarily need to be going for that long of a time. You don't have to go for hours and hours at a time. So there are some research that has been done with children, and it found that them swimming just 3 minutes a day caused them to have this improvement in their memory and cognition when they did it over a week span. In older individuals, we found 15 to 20 minutes a day, but doing it at least 3 days a week can help improve cognition. So it's not a long, like I said, you don't have to do it for hours.
Yeah, 3 minutes, 15 minutes, that's hardly anything.
Right. But I think it's that continued, you know, if you can jump in for 15 minutes and then come back later in the week and jump in again. And then over time, what tends to happen is as people get more comfortable, they just want to stay in longer. And whether that would have more benefits or not, we don't know. But that's what people are looking into right now.
I'm speaking with Sina Matthew. She's a professor of biology at the University of Mary Hardin Baylor, and she's looked at and compiled a lot of the research on the mental benefits of swimming. Professor Matthew, how much, we've talked about that it can do all these great things for the brain. How much is that? Like, is someone going to see a huge difference? Could this help with like dementia, or how big of a difference do these benefits make?
So we are limited, or I would say we're somewhat limited in the amount of research in terms of humans compared to animals. And so I will just refer to some of the research on animals, if that's okay.
But yeah.
When we look at research in animals, If we look at different disease models like temporal lobe epilepsy or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or ALS, what has been found, like if we look at the temporal lobe epilepsy animals, you give them a lesion in their brain to mimic temporal lobe epilepsy and have them swim for a month period, and I think it was only like 15 to 30 minutes that they were swimming at a time, but they swam for a whole month. And within their brain, they had more neurons, so that they increased the number of neurons that were actually in their brain, and then they also had more dendritic branches. So the dendrite is the part of your neuron that is accepting signals. And so they were getting more of these branches in their brain just after a month of swimming in these animals. And then they saw that also if they waited, say, 2 months after the surgery to give them epilepsy and then had them swim, and they saw the same thing, suggesting that you don't have to immediately be swimming to see those benefits. You can wait, you know, and maybe build up your confidence and then go swimming, and you'll still see those benefits in the brain. And so that increase in the neuronal number suggests that you would have that potential to repair maybe some of the connections that were damaged that are causing the epilepsy. And they've seen this in different different animal models. So in different diseases, you have those animals swim, and the brain is slowly repairing itself with that continued swimming.
Hmm. From the research, do you think that swimming is more important for older adults that their brains are starting to decline, or also developing brains in kids?
Well, there's been research that has shown that in children, if you start them swimming early, the children that swim actually hit their developmental milestones earlier than the children who don't swim. I think one of the difficulties we have with looking at older adults is if you're an older adult and you're swimming, you've probably been swimming for a while, right?
Yeah.
We don't really have a way to compare, or it's more difficult, I guess, to compare older adults who maybe just learned to swim versus those who've known how to swim for a long time. But it has been seen in older adults as well that they have this improved cognition and memory and recall if they have been swimming compared to their peers who are more sedentary and just have not been swimming.
You wrote in your article for the Conversation website that for centuries, people have been in search of the fountain of youth. Swimming just might be the closest we can get. How serious were you about that? Do you really think that if people swim all their lives, that this could really impact their quality and length of life?
Well, I do. I think 'cause we've seen now that with swimming, you have what's known as neurogenesis, which is the creation of those new neurons. And as we are creating those new neurons and as we're improving our memory and cognition, if I think of some of the ailments that older members of my family are dealing with, it's a lot of times it's memory issues, memory and cognition issues. And if you can be swimming and help to minimize those memory impairments or, you know, completely remove them altogether, that is to me like the fountain of youth. To have the brain or a similar brain when I'm 80 or 90 to what I have now, I think would be fantastic.
Sina Matthew is a professor of biology at the University of Mary Hardin Baylor. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Ciara Hewlett.
And I'm Julie Rose. And that's it for our show today. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Riemond produced the show. We'd love to connect with you on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BYU Top of Mind. You can also listen on demand by subscribing to our podcast. Just look for Top of Mind on your favorite podcast app to get new episodes each weekday. It's been great having you along. We'll talk soon.